Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an analyst considers international cooperation in the fight against ISIS. We'll hear about increasing U.S. concern about terrorism as the race for the White House is underway. Our cyber guru tells us about a possible doomsday scenario.
These devices are decades old. They were designed before security was even a thought, and they are perhaps the biggest vulnerability facing the United States right now.
And there's a new special award for the First Lady of Country Music. It's right here on the Voice of America. Belgium, headquarters of European Union and NATO institutions, remains on its highest state of alert today, with schools and the Brussels metro system closed amid fears of a repeat of the terrorist attacks that killed 130 people and wounded hundreds in Paris November 13th. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. French President Francois Hollande, meantime, is holding a series of meetings this week with British Prime Minister David Cameron Monday, President Obama Tuesday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel Wednesday, and the Russian leader Vladimir Putin on Thursday to try to form a coalition to combat the Islamic State, which claimed responsibility for those Paris attacks. In Albania Sunday, European Union President Donald Tusk called the fight against extremism the biggest challenge of our time.
I deeply believe that terrorists will not intimidate us, and because, in fact, freedom and solidarity is much stronger than fear and violence. It's also our political obligation to be together against this dramatic challenge, maybe the biggest one in our times.
The UN Security Council on Friday unanimously authorized all necessary measures to fight jihadist violence, including the mass killings in Mali, Tunisia, Beirut, the downing of that Russian jetliner over Sinai. Monash University European Union analyst Ben Wellings in Australia told me the security lockdown in Belgium is closely tied to those Paris attacks.
The attackers in Paris did come from Belgium, and Belgian society had some of the same issues, if you like, around integration or accommodation or facilitation of minorities, particularly Muslim minorities, as France does. Not exactly the same, but not dissimilar. So in some ways it is linked to deeper themes within Belgian and Western European society. So what it seems, though, of course, is that one of the attackers has fled back to Belgium, and this is what's given the very specific, credible claim to the security crisis that we're now seeing.
Well, French President Hollande will embark on a diplomatic offensive in coming days, trying to forge a broad coalition against the Islamic State. How successful do you think he will be in forging some sort of a grand coalition?
Of course, you know, initially everyone will support this initiative. The question is to what extent and how much will that involve military cooperation, particularly on the ground. First thing to do is that David Cameron is very keen to get involved in Syria, but back in 2013 this was blocked by the Labour Party, and that means that Britain's only been involved in Iraq. It may be blocked by the Labour Party again. Barack Obama will be very receptive, but opinion in America is not favourable towards a sort of a boots-on-the-ground escalation, so that will be a difficulty there. Germany, typically reluctant to get involved beyond its own borders, even if it did have forces under NATO command in Afghanistan and Kosovo. But again, a reluctance there. The interesting thing is Russia. To what extent will France pull Russia into this orbit? So what kind of French-led coalition against ISIS will eventuate will be interesting to see. And it may be a kind of an unusual set of bedfellows that may prosecute this, all in the context of some political agreement in Syria.
This imminent threat level is in Belgium, which is at the heart of European Union institutions. What likely impact will this threat by Islamic State in the wake of the Paris attacks have on European Union unity, as well as their common response to the Islamic State?
The European Union, if you like, under some sort of stress from the collusion and the linkage between the unprecedented migration that we've seen since the summer and the months and years preceding that, but also the suggestion that one of the attackers had used these refugee migrations to disguise his entry back into Europe from Syria. So this is where the tension lies, and the problem is the kind of the sharing of refugee quotas across the EU. So there is some political risk here for the Schengen zone, the treaty that governs the free movement of peoples within 26 of the 28 member states of the EU. In terms of a coordinated response, of course, the EU doesn't really have the hard security elements that member states like Britain, France, and all the others have at the member state level. But it is trying to attempt a kind of a response to the refugee crisis. And it may be positioned to facilitate some sort of diplomatic support for the attempts to bring about a negotiated peace in Syria, which is at the heart of these particular problems.
The French and Russians say they've stepped up attacks on Islamic State targets in Syria. Meanwhile, U.S. envoy to the Global Anti-IS Coalition, Brett McGurk, told U.S. television Sunday that dozens of U.S. Special Operations Forces will be deployed to northern Syria very soon to train, advise, and assist Arab forces fighting the IS group and isolating the de facto Islamic State capital of Raqqa.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today, and joining me with the details is social media reporter Olin Akisholu. Welcome, Olin.
Hi, Susan. Well, while police in Brussels went door-to-door yesterday and the city remained on lockdown, city officials had asked social media users to refrain from posting anything that could disclose the location of police or ongoing raids. But schools were closed, public transportation was shut down. Most people just stayed in their homes and didn't have much to do. These are circumstances that often lead people to go on social media. So these conditions led to a trend of people in Brussels going on Twitter to share photos of cats with hashtag Brussels Lockdown. I'm talking everything from cat memes to cat gifs to some pretty ridiculous Photoshop pictures that have cats doing crazy things. My favorite was a meme of this one cat that's curled up tight inside of a really small plastic container, and it's captioned, "Stay inside," they said. Hashtag Brussels Lockdown. Another really funny one was a GIF that looped a cat appearing to read a military strategy book. Then you also had a lot of people taking pictures of their cats wearing sunglasses. That's sort of an internet classic. Also, plenty of jokes made about the cats keeping people safe during the lockdown. It was an interesting phenomenon and seemed like a subtle way of protesting the fear that's grown towards terrorism in the wake of the attacks on Paris more than a week ago.
Well, thank you, Olin.
Thanks, Susan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Well, you've decided to cook up that piece of meat you bought a few days ago, but you wonder if it's spoiled. Many of us use the old sniff test. If the meat smells kind of funny, we become concerned. But commercial food suppliers who supply tons of meat to consumers need more than that sniff test to determine if the meat they're about to ship is good. Scientists writing in the American Chemical Society Journal say that they've come up with a new portable and simple system to determine whether meat is safe to eat. Using extremely fluorescent and hollow nanotubes, this newly developed system detects the compounds that are emitted as meat decomposes. The compounds cause the bright fluorescent nanotubes to dim. The researchers exposed their device to meat that sat in a refrigerator for a couple of days and found that more than a 10% decrease in the tube's glow meant that the meat is spoiled. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Heightened concerns over possible terrorist threats are registering with U.S. residents. Senate correspondent Michael Bowman tells VOA's Jim Stevenson new polling data from ABC News and the Washington Post newspaper show an electorate increasingly focused on security issues after the deadly Islamic State attacks in Paris.
We're starting to see the first results of polls that were conducted of the American public after the attacks in Paris. And as perhaps we should not be surprised, security concerns, and in particular concerns about terrorism, have leapt significantly. It's right behind the economy. Concerns about terrorism is the number one listed for 28% of voters who expect to vote next year in the presidential contest. The economy is still the number one concern for 33%. But still, this is a striking development for an election that until very recently everyone had assumed was going to hinge on the economy.
Immigration had become a big issue among some of the candidates, mostly because of Donald Trump. And now with the terrorism aspect of it, that has played into that rhetoric out on the campaign trail and among the candidates.
Indeed. For months, people like Donald Trump, the Republican frontrunner, had been talking about sort of the foreign threat, but in the form of people who wanted to cross America's borders illegally. His focus on the campaign trail today is very much Syrian refugees. There is a political firestorm over this that I don't know anyone could have seen coming just a couple of weeks ago. Donald Trump, just in the last couple of days, has said that we need to keep them out and that for those that are here, that there should be a registry, a database for them. Hillary Clinton has said on the Democratic side, has said, well, no, this is anti-American, and this provides propaganda fodder for the Islamic State and other groups. Normally, it takes Congress months, years to act on anything. Mm-hmm. But within 10 days of the attacks in Paris, we had the House of Representatives voting to halt the flow of Syrian refugees entirely until some very stringent reviews can be done and new procedures put in place. Now, the administration points out there are millions of people who come to the United States each and every year from all corners of the earth, and many of them don't even need a visa. Many of them, if they're from a European country, a Western European country, can just waltz right in. Others come on tourist visas. There are easier ways to get into the United States than waiting 18 to 24 months to come in as a refugee.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Coming up on International Edition, brace yourself for some scary cyber news. And country music's Loretta Lynn is once again honored. Security in Washington and across the United States is tightening following new videos reportedly released by Islamic State, specifically threatening an attack on New York City and Washington. But while security officials work to harden potential targets against any terrorist threats, a growing number of cybersecurity analysts are warning some of the most critical U.S. assets are all but unprotected, namely the nation's millions of digital operational networks that control everything from water treatment to manufacturing to the electric grid. International Edition's Doug Bernard, our cyber specialist, is here with me. Doug, you're scaring me again.
Well, perhaps with good cause. And it's not me, ideally, who's scaring you. But there are a lot of cybersecurity analysts out there who indeed are saying some very scary things. What they're talking about specifically are not sort of security things that we've spoken about often. Our computers being, you know, infected, data being stolen from networks, that sort of thing. This is something very different. It's called OT, operational technology. And it involves the millions upon millions of small devices that control many of our industrial processes. So they're not they're not used for emailing or for other kinds of things. They're monitoring pressure. They're monitoring temperature, that sort of thing, and making adjustments so that everything works properly. Now, in order for all of these devices to do their job, they need to talk to each other. But many analysts, and I've actually spoken with a number of analysts looking for a counter view, and I couldn't find it. To a last one, they all said these devices are decades old. They were designed before security was even a thought, and they are perhaps the biggest vulnerability facing the United States right now.
When it snows in Washington, the city comes to a standstill. Right. But we still stay home and get on the computers and the phones and have lights right. And have heat and everything.
Right.
Doesn't this mean that it's a possibility that we could get even more frozen out?
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually a great term. Several high-ranking U.S. officials, in fact, have used that exact scenario. So let's take the power grid, for example. If hacking groups were able to gain access to, let's say several devices, creating actual physical destruction at power generating facilities. So for a period of time, there's no power generated. Those generators contribute to the national electric grid. If you have several of them drop out at once, you could have major portions, say the entire eastern seaboard, power simply fail, not fail for hours or days, but people are saying literally for weeks or months until the equipment is being able to be repaired. That would lead to complete, I think, chaos nationally. Now, that's a worst-case doomsday scenario, but the analysts that I've spoken with all say we need to be thinking about this because, well, one, they say it's not a matter of if, it's simply a matter of when and how bad.
You're going to say there is no cure for this at this time. We've got to think of it.
Well, there are cures, but what it takes is serious, concerted effort by governments and by industry to correct these systems. That is a multi-billion-dollar, multi-year process.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Doug.
You bet.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Loretta Lynn is known as the First Lady of Country Music. She's receiving a new award in honor of her many decades of country hits. International Edition's Sarah Williams speaks with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about this latest tribute.
The 2015 Billboard Women in Music Awards takes place December 11th in New York City. It's a ceremony that's continuing to develop and grow. This year, they've added a new award, the first ever Billboard Women in Music Legend Award. Country icon Loretta Lynn will be its first recipient. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to talk about it. Nikki, this is a huge honor. Tell us about Loretta Lynn's legacy.
Okay, Loretta is awesome. She's a trailblazer. Her work is marked with fearlessness and honesty. She became a part of the country music scene in the 1960s. Now, as a songwriter, she wrote about whatever she wanted, as long as it spoke to other women, and many of her songs were autobiographical. So her songs focused a lot on blue-collar women's issues. She talked about cheating men and persistent mistresses, both of which she dealt with in her marriage. She wrote about many things that were considered scandalous, too. She sang about birth control in her song The Pill, double standards for men and women, being widowed after the draft during the Vietnam War in her song, for example, Dear Uncle Sam, she talked about or sang about the loss of teenage virginity. Consequently, many country radio stations actually banned her music. But she continued to persevere, and she became one of the major legends who continued to lay the groundwork for many of the country artists that you see today, female and otherwise. In 1976, she released her autobiography, Coal Miner's Daughter. It became the number one bestseller, making her the first country music artist to make the New York Times bestseller list. This opened the door for tons of other country artists to write books. And then in 1980, her autobiography, The Coal Miner's Daughter, became an Oscar-winning film. And in the early 1980s, she became the first American female recording artist to chart over 50 top 10 hits. She has been inducted. I mean, it's extensive. She's been inducted into more Music Halls of Fame than any other female recording artist. In 2010, she received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award for her 50 years in country music. President Barack Obama honored her with a Presidential Medal of Freedom. She was also a recipient of the Kennedy Center Honor in 2003, and she is also the first female country artist to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1977. So the awards, the honors, the hit songs are extensive. And her partnership, I would be remiss if I didn't include this, her partnership with Conway Twitty was quite prosperous and filled with tons of accomplishments as well. They are the most successful and most awarded male-female duet team in country music history.
Now, she's about to release a new CD as well.
Yeah, I think this is perfect timing. So this will be her first solo album in more than 10 years. It's called Full Circle. It's set to drop March 4th. It'll be a little bit of the old and a little bit of the new. According to a press release, the project takes listeners on a journey through Loretta's musical story, from the Appalachian folk songs and gospel music she learned as a child to new interpretations of her classic hits and country standards to songs newly written for the project. So I know it includes a duet with Willie Nelson and a song with Elvis Costello. Also, on the same day that Full Circle is released, a new documentary about her life and career is going to air on PBS. It's called American Masters, Loretta Lynn, Still a Mountain Girl. So that will happen March 4th as well. And Full Circle is now available on pre-order, too.
Well, you can hear more about country music with Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music and on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter in a cabin on a hill in Butcher Holler. We were poor, but we had love. That's the one thing that Daddy made sure of. He shoveled coal to make a poor man's dollar.
We would like to invite you to join us on Twitter at VOA underline IE. If you'd like to hear today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, at the very beginning of a new millennium, the world faces what Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken called a threat that does not stop at borders and does not distinguish among its victims. In every corner of the globe, in every country represented here today in ways big and small, violent extremists have left their mark, murdering, terrorizing, and preaching an ideology of nihilism and fear that seeks to defy humanity. These remarks came at a high-level event on preventing violent extremism through education, organized by the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, and the permanent mission of the United States during the 38th General Conference at UNESCO headquarters. Deputy Secretary Blinken added, "Our weapon of choice in this fight is a weapon surpassing any that extremists possess, one that delivers a blow that no agent of hate or intolerance can withstand. It is the bright light of education." In the words of UNESCO Director General Irina Bokova, "Violent extremists offer destruction and hatred. We must respond with culture and knowledge. Violent extremists promote fear and division. We must respond with skills for critical thinking, with opportunities for civic engagement, with competences for dialogue across cultures." UNESCO has a program available to ministries that request it called Global Citizenship Education. It helps create a learning environment that promotes a free exchange of ideas. The hope is to raise a generation of responsible global citizens by instilling in students a respect for human rights, social justice, diversity, gender equality, and environmental sustainability. Building on this program, the United States will take the next step and help develop a digital education resource to prevent and undermine the allure of violent extremism. by arming young minds with a world perspective rooted in respect, social justice, diversity, and critical thinking, we can counter radicalization as it arises and even prevent its growth in the first place, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. By investing in their future, we secure ours. The alternative is too tragic to even contemplate. Without a quality education, these children are in danger of being exploited, forced to work, pressured into early marriage, conscripted as child soldiers, or become prey to the siren song of violent extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.